the headlines, Palestinian resistance groups vow Israel will pay a heavy price for its crimes. Also in the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces launch a fresh raid on the flashpoint city of Nablus. And Imran Khan is arrested during a court appearance in Islamabad. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip hold a funeral for victims of Israel's aerial strikes that claimed the lives of 13 Palestinians. Mourners condemned the Israeli regime's air raids while carrying the bodies of the victims in Gaza. Three senior members of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, as well as 10 others, including their family members, have been killed. Gaza medics say 4 children are among the killed. 20 people have been injured, some of them seriously. The regime claims that it has targeted Islamic Jihad leaders and the group's weapons manufacturing sites. 40 aircraft and drones were involved in the attacks. The Gaza deaths bring to over 120 the number of Palestinians killed so far this year. The Israeli regime has warned settlers living near Gaza to stay close to bomb shelters in the coming hours over concerns about retaliatory rocket attacks from the besieged Gaza Strip. The Israeli army has ordered the closure of schools, beaches, and highways in cities and towns in southern Israel and limited public gatherings. Israel's military affairs minister says the regime should be prepared for a prolonged campaign and widening ranges of fire. The regime has imposed a total lockdown on Gaza, which has been blockaded for years. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has vowed to avenge the death of 3 of its senior members in Israel's pre-dawn strikes on Gaza. Spokesman Tariq Salimi says the bombardment will be met by bombardment and the attack will be met by attack, Dawood Shahab. Another Islamic Jihad spokesman warned that the resistance now considers all Israeli cities and settlements as legitimate targets. Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh also vowed that the regime will pay the price for the attack. He said the assassination of resistance leaders will not bring security to the regime. It will instead bring more acts of resistance by Palestinians. Hamas spokesman Hassan Qasim also warned the Israeli regime over its latest atrocity in the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli occupation committed a great crime and treacherous aggression against our people in the Gaza Strip by bombing residential areas and homes, which led to the killing of children and women and targeted the leaders of the resistance. Our people and the resistance know how to respond to this great crime and make the occupation pay the price for this aggression on the Gaza Strip.
The Palestinian resistance group Lion's Den has also warned Tel Aviv of surprise and unprecedented retaliatory attacks. The group warned that time is running out and the gates of hell will open up to the regime in the West Bank. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry has called for international mediation to stop the Israeli strikes on Gaza. The Joint Command of Resistance Groups, an umbrella group comprising Palestinian armed factions in Gaza, also said the regime should be prepared to pay the price for the attack. We talked to journalist and activist Khalid Barakat about Israel's fresh deadly strikes on the Gaza Strip. He said the regime is seeking to turn attention from its own crisis at the expense of Palestinian people's lives.
This heinous Israeli crime it comes in a time where the Israeli government is in crisis. They're trying to solve their crisis at the expense of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance. And for the past 3 weeks, at least, we have been the warning that Israel is going to carry assassination against Palestinian leaders, especially in Gaza. The Palestinian resistance have said repeatedly that this is what Israel is planning to do. And in fact, we have even spoken about this in this show, and that is, you know, the Palestinian resistance are aware that Israel was plotting to assassinate Palestinian resistance. And this crime comes in a time where the Palestinian people are just about a week from commemorating 75 years of the continuing Nakba, the catastrophe of 75 years of exile and expulsion and dispossession.
Condemnations are pouring in over the recent pre-dawn strikes by the Israeli regime that killed more than a dozen people. Regional countries declaring solidarity with grieving Palestinians. Iran's foreign ministry says the attacks show the regime's weakness in the face of growing resistance of Palestinian youth. It stressed the Israeli regime needs to be held accountable and pay the price for the bloodshed. Syria also offered condolences, vowing Damascus will continue to support the Palestinian people and their cause. It called for action to put an end to the Israeli bloodshed. In Lebanon, Hezbollah stressed that the martyrdom of resistance commanders will only make the nation more determined to continue on the path of the resistance. Hezbollah called the cowardice massacre of innocent women and children a crime against humanity. Also, the Jordanian foreign ministry urged the international community to prevent the Israeli regime from committing such heinous crimes. Meanwhile, Israeli forces keep intensifying their crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. At least a dozen people, including a teenager, have suffered bullet wounds during an Israeli raid on the flashpoint city of Nablus. The raid also left over 100 others injured by gas inhalation. The regime troopers stormed a residential area to arrest Palestinians for their alleged role in an anti-Israeli operation. They shelled their house and opened fire at residents protesting against the raid. Two Palestinians were also detained. Israel has stepped up its attacks on occupied Palestinian towns and cities in recent months. Over 100 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank so far this year. Iran says the U.S. dealt a deadly blow to the international rule of law with its exit from the 2015 deal. It also is known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The deputy foreign minister made these comments in a tweet to mark the fifth year of the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA and its imposition of unilateral sanctions on Iran. Ali Bagharikani underlined the effective removal of sanctions remains key to the full implementation of the agreement. Bagharikani added that this will be possible through the political will of the U.S. and European violators of the deal to finalize the negotiations on its revival. But he warned that the window of opportunity in this regard will not remain open permanently. The issue of sanctions and Iran's remedial measures in response to the U.S. pullout remain the main sticking point in the talks. Now, the fifth edition of the Export Potential Exhibition of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which kicked off on Sunday, has been a perfect opportunity to attract foreign investors and boost national revenues. Hundreds of investment projects have been unveiled on the sidelines of this exhibition. Mahdi Abbasian reports.
The fifth international exhibition of the export capabilities of Iran is underway at Tehran International Permanent Fairground from May 7th to 10th. The event aims to help companies export their products, develop new markets, and promote their industries while focusing on the importance of non-oil exports. One of the most successful contributors to Iran's non-oil revenues is the country's free industrial and trade zones, which accounted for one-third of the country's non-oil exports last year. During a press conference, the secretary of Iran's Free Zones High Council, said 370 major investment projects are going to be executed in 7 free trade zones across the country, and all investors are welcome to participate in these projects.
Our colleagues have conducted preliminary studies about investment in the 7 free industrial and trade zones. Preliminary justification plans have been prepared, which shows that these projects are going to be profitable. Studies related to the market, land, energy, etc. have also been conducted.
There are 7 active free zones in Iran, including Kish, Chabahar, Qeshm, Anzali, Aras, Arvand, and Maku. According to official statistics, the free zones' productions were about $1 billion last year. One of the most important free zones with lots of potential is the Chabahar free zone.
Chabahar free zone is located near the Mokran coastal region. Based on the description of the Islamic Republic of Iran's leader, this region is a hidden treasure in Iran. He has mentioned this several times. As the 3rd energy hub of the country, petrochemical units are going to be opened in Chabahar. These units will begin production after 2 years, and their products will be ready to be introduced to the global market.
Free zones have helped the process of development of Iran through providing conditions that have attracted foreign investors. Officials say the development of projects in free zones is expected to attract a huge volume of investment valued at $5 billion to Iran's economy. The projects are also going to generate new employment opportunities for 23,000 job-seeking people at large. Iran Expo 2023 has introduced hundreds of investment opportunities in the country's trade and industrial free zones. The free zones of Iran, as one of the important tools of development, play an important role in the prosperity of the national economy. Ahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
We talked to a businessman from Pakistan about the importance of this expo. He believes that his country has a population of around 240 million people and has great potential for Iran-made products.
We are very thankful to the Iran Expo authorities. They invited us to visit here, a very wonderful place. And actually, we are in food business. Especially, our group is involved in dried fruit items. We buy Iranian items indirectly to Pakistan. And Pakistan is a huge market, big market, around 2400 million population, and we use it in our religious rituals, like in Ramadan we are taking these dates. So it's a huge potential in Pakistan for Iranian product. We also are the producer from Pakistan, but Iranian varieties are different, which is very our people like it so much, Iranian products. So that's why we are here. We now want to establish our business direct to from Iran to Pakistan. So when we came here and our delegation came here, so we are very much impressed for Iran hospitality and so many other exciting avenues over here.
To Pakistan now, former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has been arrested in a move that threatens fresh political turmoil in the country. Khan was detained by the National Accountability Bureau in connection with a corruption case. Scores of security personnel in riot gear took him away in a van from the Islamabad High Court, where he had gone to seek bail in multiple cases registered against him. In a tweet posted just hours before his arrest, Khan claimed that attempts to detain him aimed to prevent him from campaigning ahead of this year's general elections. He said the move is an attempt to stop him from mobilizing people in case the Supreme Court violates the Constitution regarding the holding of elections. Meantime, thousands of Khan's supporters have taken to the streets across the country. Clashes erupted as police fired tear gas and water cannons to disperse protesters in Karachi and Lahore. The ralliers also blocked roads in the capital Islamabad and neighboring Rawalpindi and Peshawar. In the meantime, the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party has called for nationwide protests. Khan is the chairman of this party. He was removed from power in April last year after he lost a parliamentary vote of confidence. Khan is accused of a host of charges ranging from terrorism to corruption, which he says are all politically motivated and false. In a tit-for-tat move, China has expelled a diplomat from Canada's consulate in Shanghai after Ottawa canceled and asked the Chinese diplomat to leave the country.
Countermeasure in reaction to Canada's unscrupulous move, China decides to declare the Council of the Consulate General of Canada in Shanghai persona non grata, who has been asked to leave China before May 13th.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman also said that Beijing reserves the right to respond further to Ottawa's unreasonable actions. He added that China's move is to safeguard its legitimate rights and interests. On Monday, Canada announced the expulsion of a diplomat from the Chinese consulate in Toronto for allegedly interfering in the country's internal affairs. Beijing has rejected the accusation, saying it has no interest in doing so. Diplomatic tensions between the two countries have been running high since the detention of a top executive of the Chinese firm Huawei in 2018. Beijing's subsequent arrest of two Canadians on spying charges, all three were freed in 2021. The World Health Organization says nearly a month of armed conflict in Sudan has also left 604 people dead. The UN Health Agency says fighting in the North African country has also injured thousands of others. The figure provides a clearer snapshot of the scale of the crisis. The International Organization of Migration says 700,000 people have been internally displaced, and half of these over the past week. This comes as Saudi sources said 3 days of ongoing talks in Jeddah between delegations of the warring sides have made no significant progress. The source said a permanent ceasefire is not on the table. Clashes erupted between Sudan's army and a paramilitary group in mid-April over the latter's proposed integration into the regular armed forces. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump will not testify in writer E. Jean Carroll's civil defamation and battery case against him, after a Sunday afternoon deadline passed without the former president filing a motion to reopen the case. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump rejected his last chance on Sunday, 7th of May, to testify at a civil trial where a longtime advice columnist has accused him of raping her in a luxury department store dressing room in 1996. Donald Trump, a Republican candidate for president in 2024, was given until 5 p.m. on Sunday, 7th of May, by U.S. District Judge Lewis Kaplan to file a request to testify. But nothing was filed. It was not a surprise. Donald Trump has not shown up once during the two-week Manhattan trial, where writer E. Jean Carroll testified for several days, repeating claims that she first made publicly in a 2019 memoir. She is seeking compensatory and punitive damages totaling millions of dollars. The jury has also watched lengthy excerpts from an October videotape deposition in which Donald Trump vehemently denied raping E. Jean Carroll or even really knowing her. Without Trump's testimony, lawyers were scheduled to make closing arguments on Monday, with deliberations likely to begin on Tuesday, 9th of May. After plaintiffs rested their case on Thursday, Trump attorney Joe Tacopina immediately rested the defense case as well as without calling any witnesses. He did not request additional time for Donald Trump to decide to testify. Joe Tacopina declined in an email to comment after the deadline passed on Sunday, 7th of May. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Lewis Kaplan had given Donald Trump extra time to change his mind and request to testify. Though the judge did not promise he would grant such a request to reopen the defense case so Trump could take the stand. At the time, Judge Lewis Kaplan noted that he'd heard about news reports on Thursday in which Donald Trump told reporters while visiting his golf course in Doonbeg, Ireland, that he would probably attend the trial. Trump also criticized Judge Kaplan, a Bill Clinton appointee, as an extremely hostile and rough judge who doesn't like me very much. On the witness stand, E. Jean Carroll, 79 years old, testified that Donald Trump, 76 years old, raped her in spring of 1996 after they met at the entrance of the Midtown Manhattan department store Bergdorf Goodman. She said the encounter began as a fun and flirtatious outing as Trump coaxed her into helping him shop for a gift for another woman. She said they ended up in the store's desolate lingerie section where they teased each other to try on a see-through bodysuit. As E. Jean Carroll recalled it, laughter accompanied them into the dressing room where Donald Trump became violent, slamming her against the wall and trying to sexually assault her. In his deposition, Donald Trump said E. Jean Carroll made it up. He called it a false, disgusting lie delivered by a nutjob who was trying to stoke sales of her book. He also repeated comments he made in statements that she was not his type. "She's not my type, and that's 100% true," he said. And he repeated his claims in a 2005 Access Hollywood video in which he bragged that men who are celebrities can sexually assault women. "Historically, that's true with stars," he said. E. Jean Carroll sued Donald Trump in November, minutes after New York State enacted a law allowing adult sexual assault victims to sue others even if the attacks occurred decades ago. E. Jean Carroll's attorney, Roberta Kaplan, wrote a letter to the judge on Sunday to complain that Donald Trump still has not removed April 26 post on his social media network in which he called Carroll's allegations a made-up scam. And she noted that he repeated disparaging remarks about the trial 3 days ago in Ireland. After the 26th of April posting on Truth Social, Judge Kaplan, who is not related to E. Jean Carroll's lawyer, said Trump's comments were highly inappropriate and expressed concern that Donald Trump was trying to communicate to the jury about stuff that has no business being spoken about. The U.S. national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump will not testify in writer E. Jean Carroll's civil defamation and battery case against him after a Sunday afternoon deadline passed without the former president filing a motion to reopen the case. The two sides each rested their cases on Friday after Donald Trump declined to testify in his own defense, but Judge Lewis Kaplan gave Donald Trump until Sunday, 7th of May, to reconsider. Setting an afternoon deadline for Trump to file a motion to reopen the case for the sole purpose of testifying, in light of remarks that Donald Trump made while golfing in Europe, suggesting he would return to New York to confront his accuser. E. Jean Carroll, who brought the lawsuit in November, alleges that Donald Trump defamed her in his Truth Social post by calling her allegations a hoax and a lie, and saying, "This woman is not my type," when he denied her claim that Trump raped her in a Bergdorf Goodman dressing room in the 1990s. The former Elle magazine columnist added a charge of battery under a recently adopted New York law that allows adult survivors of sexual abuse to sue their alleged attacker regardless of the statute of limitations. Donald Trump has denied all the allegations that he raped E. Jean Carroll or defamed her. Each side is expected to deliver closing statements on Monday. The judge is then expected to charge the jury on Tuesday, 9th of May, followed by the start of deliberations. This month's trial is taking place as Donald Trump seeks the White House for a third time, while facing numerous legal challenges related to the 6th of January Capitol attack, his handling of classified material after leaving the White House, and possible attempts to interfere in Georgia's 2020 presidential election.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Abu Dhar al-Ghifari, his name was actually Jundam bin Junada al-Ghifari from the Ghifar tribe. He was not only very highly regarded by the Prophet, but as I said earlier, he is among those who are known to be in the company of Ali, even during the life of the Prophet. The Prophet actually had said, no sky has covered and no land has, carried anyone more truthful in his speech than Abu Dhar. On a practical level in history, we see that he never shied away from talking about the truth. During the days of Uthman especially, he used to actually sit down in Masjid al-Nabi and talk about Ahlul Bayt, about Ali. The informers would go to the Khalifa and tell him, this is what Abu Dhar is doing, gathering people and, talking bad about you, criticizing your policies, and then talking about Ali. And they especially mentioned one story. They said, one day he was sitting there by the gate of the Masjid al-Nabi, and he had gathered the people there, and this is what he said, أَيُّهَةَ الْأُمَّةُ الْمُتَحَيِّرَةُ, O the confused community, referring to the Muslims at the time. لو قدمتم من قدم الله وأخرتم من أخر الله. If you had put forward the person whom Allah had put forward, and if you had pushed back those whom Allah had pushed back, and you have accepted the leadership and successorship of the Prophet in form of Ahlul Bayt, he says, you would have been blessed by the sky above you and the ground beneath you. Very similar to the words even Salman had used, that if you had accepted Ahlul Bayt, the blessings would have been multiplied. You know the way Salman used the term where he says, you got a little gold, but you lost the gold mine. And this is what even Salman, Abu Zar also in different ways is describing. And then he says, فَعَمَّا إِذَا فَعَلْتُمْ مَا فَعَلْتُمْ. Now that you have done what you have done, then you would see the consequences of your decision. And he ends with the ayah, سَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُ أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ. And those who are unjust will soon know when the times change. This fearless criticism of Osman's nepotism and unjust, you know, policy, especially in distribution of the public, treasury, was something he could not accept at all. And he actually would criticize Osman on his face. Once Osman sent his son-in-law, Marwan bin Hakam, they didn't know the quality of this person, with some money. They wanted to buy him. A Shia of Ali is not bought for his iman. He doesn't sell his iman at all. Abu Zar told him, Marwan, what is this? Oh, Khalifa has given you. Has he given to everyone? Same amount? He says, no, this is specially for you. He says, then go and keep it. Give it back to him. Tell him, I don't want. And finally, Osman decided to exile him to Sham. This is where, we are told that we don't respect the Sahaba. MashaAllah, they used to respect the Sahaba. This is a great companion of Rasulullah. They exiled him to Sham. After some time, Muawiyah wrote a letter to Osman, what is this problem you have pushed towards me? Because he's criticizing me all the time. And he's going around to different places in Sham, spreading this praise about Ali and his family. Some of our historians actually say that the seeds of Shiaism in Lebanon, which was part of, Sham, was there sown by Abu Dhar during his visit. Finally, Osman said, okay, send him back. So he sent him back. But Abu Dhar was not going to change his attitude. Back in Medina, again, the same thing. He started, even reciting the ayat of Quran about people who accumulate wealth in a wrong way. He says, this is what's going to happen to them. Again, he gets a message from Khalifa, don't say these things. He said, well, are you telling me not to recite the ayat of Quran? I'm not going to stop. Eventually, the Khalifa calls him and says, I've decided to exile you again. He says, okay, where do you want me to go? Makkah? I'll spend my life there worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He says, no. What about Kufa? No. All these major cities? Because they didn't want him to go and associate with people. Otherwise, he'll be spreading this praise for the Ahlul Bayt. So he gave all these names and he says, no. He says, I'm going to exile you to a desert area where no one is there. And Abu Zar said, I remember the Prophet was saying, I will be all alone, even in my death. And so he, his wife, and his daughter, the announcement was done that they are being sent to Rabza, a desert area, and nobody is allowed to go and talk to them when they are leaving the city. Marwan bin Hakam was given the responsibility of making sure nobody talks to Abu Zar when they are leaving Medina. But Ali could not tolerate that. He, with his brother Aqil, with his sons, Hassan and Hussein, and even with Abdullah bin Ja'far and Miqdad, they all went to bid farewell to Abu Dharr. Marwan came there with his horse, tried to prevent. And this is where Amir al-Mu'minin just, you know, hit his horse, said, "Move away. You're not going to stop me and us from meeting Abu Dharr." The conversation which took place, which is there in Ahl Balagha also, where Ali says this, that Abu Dharr, you did it for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You were angry with them, not for yourself, for your religion. And they were angry with you because of their dunya. So be assured that you are in a high esteem in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And especially he asked Hassan and Hussein, you know, do khuda hafizi with your uncle. And he said, Abu Dharr, that all this is happening because I love you. I love Ahlul Bayt because of the love of Rasulullah. And he went, and we know the shahadat, you know, incident there, and the wafat of Abu Dharr, the way it happened. And the Prophet had told Abu Dharr that although you will die alone, but there will be a group of companions who will come and bury you. And this is where people like Malik Ashtar and others were passing by that area when his wife said that, you know, the Sahabi of Rasulullah has died and we don't have anyone to help us to bury him. So they were the one who actually, you know, gave him ghusl and kafan and buried him there.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matin. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
Limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is facing a backlash from his own party after hundreds of Tory councillors lost their seats in local elections. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story. In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is facing a growing backlash after he suffered a disastrous set of local elections as hundreds of Tory councillors lost their seats. The Prime Minister admitted the results were disappointing, but said he did not believe there had been a massive groundswell of movement towards the Labour Party. While Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer declared that his party's fantastic results showed that Labour was on course to win the next general election, some pollsters said Sir Keir Starmer had not done enough to be confident of outright victory. Meanwhile, Sir Ed Davey, the Liberal Democrats' leader, refused to rule out joining the Labour Party in a coalition if there is a hung parliament. As of 2:30 a.m. in the early hours of Saturday morning, 6th of May, the Conservatives had lost 960 councillors and lost control of 48 councils, while the Labour Party had gained 635 seats and gained 22 councils. The Liberal Democrats had gained 12 councils and 416 councillors. With all but two seats declared, the Conservatives were on a total of 2,287 councillors and 33 councils, while Labour were on 2,652 councillors and they controlled 71 councils. And the Liberal Democrats, with 1,615 councillors, were in control of 29 councils. On Friday, 5th of May, in what the Liberal Democrats called the Portillo moment of the election, the party took control of Michael Gove's local council of Surrey Heath. Sir Ed Davey's party are hopeful of taking a swathe of blue wall seats from Tory heartlands at the next general election. Other prominent Conservatives with Surrey seats include Jeremy Hunt and Dominic Raab. A party source said Liberal Democrats have won big in Michael Gove's backyard of Surrey Heath, taking control from the Conservatives. This is the Michael Portillo moment of these local elections. Senior Conservative cabinet members are now looking nervously over their shoulders at the Liberal Democrats. Also on Friday, 5th of May, Labour overtook the Conservatives to become the largest party in local government in Britain. They now have more seats than the Tories across England. As well as illustrating the party's strength across the country, it means they will take control of the local government association. Labour snatched seats from the Tories in the Red Wall in the north of England, and the Lib Dems took seats in the southern Blue Wall. The Tories lost Medway to Labour, who will run the Kent Council for the first time since 1988, with the outgoing Conservative Council leader telling Number 10 Downing Street to get their act together on multiple fronts. The Conservatives also lost Stratford-upon-Avon, the seat of Naveem Zahawi, the former Chancellor. Also to go were Hertsmere district of Oliver Dowden, the Deputy Prime Minister, and Welwyn Garden City and Hatfield, the area of Grant Shapps, the Energy Secretary. Labour gained the totemic Red Wall Council of Stoke-on-Trent, as well as winning Plymouth, along with Middlesbrough Mayor. Hailing the results, Sir Keir Starmer said Labour blew the doors off in places such as Medway, adding, "Make no mistake, we're on course for a Labour Party majority at the next general election." Rishi Sunak is facing a growing backlash after preemptively blaming the losses on the box set drama that engulfed the Conservatives during the premierships of Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, instead of addressing the party's current problems. Responding to the results, Rishi Sunak said, "It is always disappointing to lose hard-working Conservative councillors. I'm not detecting any massive groundswell of movement towards the Labour Party or excitement for their agenda. What people want us to do is focus on their priorities. Hugh Merriman, a transport minister, said constituents were complaining to him about older news about former prime ministers. Asked if the poor showing was Boris Johnson and Liz Truss's fault, Hugh Merriman said, "Certainly on the doorstep, the feedback I got was that we are in a better place. The opinion polls show, they show that as well, people are reacting in a more positive way towards Rishi Sunak." But one Conservative source said, "Rishi Sunak can't blame these results on last year's chaos. He started that chaos by knifing the most successful Tory election winner in the past 50 years. Sunak's claim that stability has been restored is shot to bits. These results are on track to be catastrophic for the Conservative Party and worse than before the change of leader." Others demanded he change policies if he is to have a chance of winning the next election. Sir John Redwood, the former cabinet minister, called for an emergency budget. He told The Telegraph, "Disillusioned Tory voters just don't think we care about them. The endless tax attacks with everything from motoring taxes to VAT on fuel to the stealth taxes on income are deeply unpopular. People are very unhappy with the lack of progress so far, lack of progress on growth, on inflation, on taxes and on migration." Sir Christopher Chope, the MP for Christchurch since 1997, added, "My view is we can't carry on like this. We need to change direction and make it clear to people what we stand for." Another Tory MP urged Rishi Sunak to go beyond managerial competence to set out his vision, while a fourth added, "When you do worse than your top loss prediction, something's gone badly wrong." Newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. What I'm hearing on the doorstep is that people are giving Rishi Sunak a chance, the Conservative Party chairman, Greg Hands, insisted in the face of a disastrous night for the Conservative Party. Among Conservative MPs with positive spin on the loss of hundreds and possibly as much as 1,000 Tory seats was not going down well on Friday. Some have even bluntly admitted the terribleness of the results. Johnny Mercer, the MP for Plymouth Moor, where Labour gained the local council, gave the most direct admonition to his party that it would need to learn from this and make a material difference to the quality of people's lives. What Rishi Sunak will need to worry about in the short term to medium term is whether his backbenchers are prepared to give him time to turn things around in the face of an increasingly likely general election win for Labour. If the view takes hold that a Labour victory against Rishi Sunak is inevitable, some Conservative MPs will in effect throw in the towel, take on second jobs and mentally check out of politics for the next year. One Tory MP with a relatively safe southern seat said his main reaction was mulling his own private sector job options, given his lack of appetite for a stint in the opposition. But others will want to put up a last-ditch fight, either by attempting to oust Rishi Sunak or pushing his politics towards their own ideological leanings that they think will be more successful with the electorate. In Prime Minister's favour, the only credible candidate as a replacement is Boris Johnson, who was ousted just 12 months ago by his MPs over an avalanche of scandals from Partygate to failure to deal with sexual harassment within his government. Certainly, there is a circle of diehard Boris Johnson fans congregating around the newly formed Conservative Democratic Organisation, or CDO, presided over by the donor Peter Cruddas and backed by the former Home Secretary Priti Patel. David Campbell Bannerman, a former Tory MEP and chair of the Conservative Democratic Organisation, CDO, told BBC that it was not a case of bringing back Boris Johnson, but that the party should not rule that out as an option in the long term, as so many members and the public still like him. David Campbell Bannerman later hardened his line, calling for a confirmatory vote of members for Rishi Sunak, adding, It was MP self-preservation that got rid of Boris Johnson. They thought they'd be better off without him. And now it's going to be MP self-preservation getting him back again. We're well adrift, and I'm afraid that it has been because Boris Johnson has been brought down with all the turbulence that resulted from it, and Rishi Sunak is in the frame for that. A Conservative source, not from the Rishi Sunak wing of the party, said, Sunak can't blame these results on last year's chaos. He started that chaos by knifing the most successful Tory election winner in the past 50 years. Sunak's claim that stability has been restored has been shot to bits. These results are on track to be catastrophic for the Conservative Party and worse than before the change of leader.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on April 18th, 2023. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. All praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the vestige of God remaining on earth. My expectation from this meeting was that the talks would be well-founded and presented using a proper literature, and praise God, this is what happened. I might not agree with some of the things you have said, but I am very happy with the quality of your talks and the organization of the content, and I am thankful to God for this. Well, it is the end of the month of Ramadan. You have had the opportunity to sit down, think, study, and organize your content. If there were time, I wouldn't mind if another 10 people spoke too. However, we are gradually approaching the time for breaking the fast, and the things I have to say in our meeting would be left unfinished. Before I begin, I would like to say a couple of things about the same things that you spoke about. First of all, a number of people sent their greetings to me. I would like to ask you to send my greetings to the brothers and sisters who asked you to send their greetings to me, especially the families of the martyrs. As for my birthday, it really isn't worthy of consideration. It is a very small and insignificant event.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Some matters were stated as complaints, problems, and recommendations, which should be discussed. So where should these things be discussed? They are not very clear or definite. They can be broken down and discussed. It seems to me that we transfer your suggestions to the planning and budget organization, in which some new activity has started, so they can attend to them. This would be a good approach. You can convey what has been said to them, or we can. Our office can act as a mediator and convey these talks to them and ask you to go there and discuss things with them. God willing, you will come to an acceptable common conclusion. Regarding the issue of privatization, which some friends mentioned here and which was repeated, and the same is being said outside, the logic that you used is incorrect. They took some wrong actions. Well, yes, any good law can be applied incorrectly. If we hand over the country's facilities, its production facilities, its factories, all these things that were operating smoothly, if we hand them over to the government will not be able to manage production facilities and large production companies.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.